Good morning, Boker Tov. Great to be back together and studying the Parsha together. I want to thank our generous sponsor for the Parsha series for the year, dear friends Becky and Avi Katz and family, in memory of Becky's father, David Grossman. Our learning should be Lila Nishmas of David and Menachem Munish. Also, this morning's particular class is co-sponsored by Meir Berkowitz in commemoration of the yahrzeit of his beloved mother, Rachel Leah Bas Tzvi, and by Rabbi Chaim and Evelyn Führer to express their hakaras hatov to Hashem for all his chasadim, and thank their friends and dedication of support throughout Evelyn's recovery from surgery. Should have a continued and complete refuah shlema. We apologize for any confusion that happened in the weekly over this. Also, I want to thank, before we begin, you may remember a couple weeks ago I mentioned I have a friend who, when I mentioned a sefer that I don't have, the next thing you know, I get the sefer in the mail. So we had quoted a Drashas Aran. He had just sent me that sefer, Drashas Aran. So you may recall I made a joke. I said, you know, I also don't have a Tesla in my driveway. So, before any of you get too excited, I did not get a Tesla in my driveway, but I did a few days later get an Amazon package in the mail. And curiously, I opened it up, and it was a model Tesla. So I want to thank Shani Braun. Shani Braun has sent me my model Tesla. So I've been debating what to ask for today. What do we not have that we would like for today? I don't know. We'll take a week off of putting the pressure on everybody. We have the privilege of studying together Parshas Mishpatim, one of my favorite parshios in the Torah. Parshas Mishpatim, as you know, is replete with countless mitzvos, but not mitzvos and commandments that we think of usually ordinarily as in ritual law, religious law, spiritual law. Parshas Mishpatim is packed with civil, tort, criminal law. All the boring, legal, encyclopedic, mundane, minutiae stuff that we don't really think feels so religious in nature. And so I want to open up with that thought. I mentioned it, I think, last year, but I want to continue with it and bring you some further sources about it, why it's so critically important, why Mishpatim is what differentiates our religion and our people. And I want to offer a charge for our Jewish educational system, something that I think that we can really, really use. In some cases, some are excelling at, and others that we need a lot of work. So Mishpatim begins with the letter Vav, Vit, Eile HaMishpatim. We are in the Aretz Kodesh, Chumash, page 416. That Vav, we all learned in school, you don't begin a sentence with the word and, Ve'eile, and these are the Mishpatim. So the Vav is a Vav Achibur. It's a Vav that is uniting. The opening Rashi and the Parsha already tells us that the Vav is connecting us to the Parsha that comes before. How is it connecting us? Last week we read about, we heard about, we learned about, we re-experienced, and we re-experience daily Kabbalah Satorah, receiving the Torah. We revisit, we go back to Sinai over and over and over again. That was the highest high, the most lofty. It was unbelievable. We were on top of the mountain. Kodesh Baruch Hu spoke to us, Bechvodo Va'atzmo, unprecedented, unparalleled revelation. Our neshama was on fire. We weren't a body struggling to remember it had a soul. We were a soul that could barely tolerate that we had a body. Our neshama was on fire. And here we are 1 week later, Ve'eila Mishpatim. You're on fire? A ne'ila, a kumzitz, a miracle, a shalashuddus, a simcha, a niggin, something that transforms you, something that elevates and elates you, something that... Oh, and by the way, if you hit someone with your car, here's what you have to pay. And if they borrowed and they took the collateral, and if you find somebody who's there, and if you work for 6 years and you want to stay, all of a sudden, ve'eila ha'mishpatim, the Vav is connecting these two experiences to unite them and as if describe that they are one. So the answer is yes. We spoke last year, and again, I don't want to revisit it. You can listen online if you weren't here. But the notion that we already have the last Mishnah in Bava Basra tells us that someone who wants to become a scholar, a chacham, should learn civil monetary law, Seder Nezikin. If you want to become a chacham, you learn Seder Nezikin. You learn all these details, civil, tort, criminal law. All of these countless details. Because what Parshas Mishpatim is basically reminding us is that Judaism and spirituality are not lived in the clouds. And religious life is not about being inspired. It's not about meditating, and it's not about being moved, and it's not about the spirituality. It's in the here and now, it's in the mundane. It's a Torah's Chaim. The Torah speaks to our everyday life. It talks about interpersonal relationships. And it talks about financial relationships. It talks about when they all go right, and it talks about when they go wrong. It paints a picture of a utopian society, and it gives us the tools to be able to navigate our way through an imperfect society. Imperfect marriage, imperfect life, imperfect business situations, imperfect community crisis. This parsha reminds us the vav, the eila, that religious life, being godly, that the message and mandate of Torah and of Yahadus are not only in the ne'ila and the kumzitz and the geshmak shir, they're also in the everyday. They're how we carry ourselves and how we interact and who we are and how we allow our lives to be informed and to be inspired. It's this framework of civil law. It's telling us how to build a society not based on our own intuition or instinct. It's telling us rules not based on our own boich. It's telling us this is Hashem's view and vision for His world. Ve'eila ha-mishpatim. Just as moved as you were by the religious experience of Matan Torah and Kabbalah Satorah, is when you leave that base medrash of Har Sinai, when you leave the shul of Har Sinai, and you go out into the workplace and at the gym and in the supermarket and in life, and the rules that govern our morals and our ethics, our responsibilities and our obligations to this world, that Vav links the two. It is one and the same. But it's not only that I mentioned last year, Ve'ila HaMishpatim. But it's much more than just that. It's also that when we study these things, right? That was the part of taking Torah to the outside world. But we also have to do a much better job of bringing Hashem into the Beis Medrash and into our study of Torah. If you go back to Parshas Vayetze, I saw an amazing idea back then. When Yaakov Avinu runs from his family's home and he lays his weary head to rest, and he has this amazing dream from which he awakens, and the pasuk describes Vayikatz Mishnaso, Vayikatz Yaakov Mishnaso, Yaakov awakens from his sleep. Vayomer, and he said, Achen yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati. Alas, there's a God here, I didn't know. I was just exhausted, I was overcome with sleep, I passed out, and he wakes up and he says, wow, I didn't realize how inspiring this place is. I didn't realize Hashem is here, and we discussed what that meant back in Parshas Vayetze, but I saw a beautiful Hasidisha insight. Several of the Rebbe say, Vayikatz Mishnaso, that word Mishnaso, Sheina, can mean sleep, but it's also the word that we use to describe reviewing Torah, study of Torah. Torah learning is Lishanos, is to learn, is to review, is to repeat. Vayikatz Mishnaso, Yaakov woke up from learning Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Basra. Vayomer, and he said, Achen yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati. He graduated 12 years of Jewish education, and he could tell you every detail of the 39 malachas, and he could tell you the Dalad of Avos Nezikin, and he could tell you the Dalad Shomrim, and he went and plowed through all of Shas, and he said, wow, I went to the Daf Yomi for 7.5 years. I didn't realize God was also at the Daf Yomi. I thought that's where we had these intellectual gymnastics and rigorous debates. I thought that's where we analyzed and we unpacked and we plumbed the depths of curiosity. I thought that's where we discussed these esoteric or criminal or civil. I thought, I didn't realize that Hashem is in b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati. A big challenge we have are our children graduating where they can repeat Yedios Klolios. Like an encyclopedia, you press play and they can rattle off information and knowledge and stuff. Is God in the information? Is God in the data? Is God in what can be repeated by memory from rote? So, okay, if you're learning about Yom Kippur and Shabbos, and you're learning Pnimiyas HaTorah, and you're learning about His Hisbodidus, and you're learning Amun and Bitachon, of course Hashem is b'makom hazeh. He is the topic of conversation. But what about when you walk out of the Beis Medrash and you just spent 8 hours, 12 hours, 15 hours, and you're talking about somebody, it's in our parsha, digs a hole in a public thoroughfare, one dug it 9 tefachim, another came and he finished it off the 10th tefach, who's liable if someone falls in? What if one dug it? Last week, I had the privilege of being in Eretz Yisrael, and I went to learn with my son-in-law, which is among the greatest joys that there possibly could be in life. And we learned with him. He's learning in the mirror. I went to shiur with him one day, and they're learning Baba Kama. Many of the yeshivas in Yerushalayim, they're learning Baba Kama. And that was the sugya. And it's amazing. And his love is the passion, the enthusiasm, the sheer numbers of people learning. If you're not moved by it, it's a Kabbalah Satorah. You're back at our Sinai. It's amazing. It's amazing. And it's not a criticism of him or them or anyone. is a challenge that we all have is at the end of that whole day. And you saw the Tzais and the Nesivas, what Reb Chaim say, Reb Shimon say, and what Reb Nachum say, what did this one say, what did that one say, and the different intellectual, how do you understand it, and is if someone dug a 10 Tvachim and someone else expanded it to 20 Tvachim, someone fell in, well, the 10 was enough for them to die, but the one who expanded it made it even more lethal, and is that similar to the person who throws the pitcher off the roof, and someone else came and smacked it and broke it before it hit the ground? Did they break the pitcher, or was the pitcher already broken because it was moving towards Mother Earth and it was going to already break, so it's as if it was broken, and they broke a broken thing, and therefore they're not liable? It's fun, it's fantastic, it's amazing. But you could go an entire Zman. You could go from after Sukkot until Pesach and Hashem b'makom hazeh. What about Hashem? So why is it? And what is it that we're doing? And they're succeeding at it, and Baruch Hashem, we're all succeeding at it, and I have nothing negative to say. But I want to share with you an insight, Rabbi Soloveitchik. He says later in the parasha, in the pasuk, if one person's bull strikes another person's bull, if your car bangs into someone else's car, who's liable? Right? In American law, it's always the person behind. Even if you stop short in front, whoever was behind was responsible to be, not always fair, but that's the law. So what is it in halacha? One person's bull damages another bull. Where's the chiyuv shmirah come from? Again, if you haven't tasted learning the geshmak, my son-in-law's Rebbe, I went through shir with him on Thursday, he said a lashon I loved. It stood in the Or Shabbos. And it came so naturally for him to say, he's nechabura of Rav Resnick. And he said, he gave over some beautiful lumdus, and then he said, I'm giving you geshmak lumdus. I want you to digest this as your own Shabbos. This is your Shabbos meal, this geshmak lumdus. It was great. The excitement, the joy, it's amazing. It's amazing. So the Rav writes, Martin Heidegger, one of the most important philosophers of the 20th century, taught ethics and spirituality at the University of Berlin in the early part of the 20th century. Yet when Hitler rose to power, he and a large coterie of his peers were among the first to embrace Nazism. The study of ethics alone cannot mold an ethical personality. The study of Torah, on the other hand, does accomplish this. Gedolei Yisrael represents spirituality, refinement in conduct, sensitivity, sympathy, compassion. Yet their primary focus is upon what's known as lumdus, a formal and abstract discipline, the study of Torah. Strangely, study the rules of the ox that gores or the egg that's laid on Yontif somehow enhances the human ethical personality, elevating both the mind and the heart. How does such study affect morality? How is it that you walk out of a Beis Medrash where for 10 hours you debated who's liable for the pitcher that fell and was broken or the hole that was dug? How is it that you will become a better person? Better husband, better father, more ethical, more moral, better community member? How does it do it? How does it do it? So writes the Rav, there's only one answer. Torah is min hashamayim. It's the word of Hashem. It ennobles one's character, redeeming a person from frivolity, vulgarity, and cruelty. It elevates him, providing meaning to his life. Torah is min hashamayim. It's Hashem's blueprint for creation. So when we sit, it's an amazing thing. And those learning the daf we recently saw, a tefillah that you say, a prayer before you learn, and a prayer you say after you learn, and the experience of learning should transform. And we sing and we dance and we hold up the books. And you don't see this paralleled in any other legal system in the world. There's no law. I mean, anyone here not a lawyer who's ever recently opened a law book? Read it? Poured over it? Analyzed it? Created mnemonics and simonim to try to remember it? Nobody on the planet. Lawyers could barely read the law books. They just do it to be able to graduate. Go become lawyers. Which is why they got into it. And yet we are a people that so highly endorses and supports and embraces and promotes and celebrates and applauds and lauds the people who pore over those books. And when we finish one of those books, we sing and we dance and we hold it and we make a party for it. And then we go back and we start again. We don't say, I'm done with the series. I put it up on the shelf, now it collects dust. But now I go start again. Because the Torah is the word of Hashem. It's His vision for this world. And the Chazon Rish writes in the Sefer Emuna Bitachon, which most of us only know from that one chapter on Emuna and Bitachon, but it's a longer volume. The Chazon Rish writes so beautifully that when we sit and we study and we learn these details, all of Parshas Mishpatim, this is Hashem's blueprint for the world. This is His vision. This is His Ratzon. It's what He wants. When two people are having a debate, when two people are having a dispute. I went on Friday in Geula, there's a great store that sells dips. my daughter sent me to, and I was eager to go back, because the last time I was in Israel, I went to that store, even more delicious than the dips that they sold, is they have a whiteboard in the back of the store, and there's a Dvar Torah written on the whiteboard. In fact, the owner, when I gave him a shkoyach for the Dvar Torah, told me, there are people who can't afford to come in, they can't afford to buy food, they come because everyone has access for free to the Divrei Torah. The nourishment for the soul everyone has, so he's so proud. Anyway, I went to go buy the dips. The dips they still had, but there was nothing on the whiteboard. So I told him at the cash, so where's the Dvar Torah? He said, I'll give you Dvar Torah. And this was the Dvar Torah that he said. The pasuk in last week's parsha, I wasn't here last week for the parsha share, so we'll make up for it now, with one word. The pasuk in last week's parsha, when Moshe is telling his father-in-law, Yisrael, that's why I had to go last week, because it's the father-in-law parsha. They didn't beg me to stay, but... Anyway, I'm joking, they did, they begged me to stay. It was beautiful, it was great, fine. Anyway, so Moshe's telling his father-in-law about the system of which he's going to hear the cases and the conflicts and adjudicate, and that's when Yisro, like every good father-in-law, is giving his unsolicited advice in this unusual, refreshing case. Moshe accepts it and follows it. So Yisro, Moshe tells him that the people, when there'll be a conflict, ba'elai, they come to me. So the Chiddush Aharon wonders, why does it say ba'elai? In the singular, it should say ba'im elai. They in the plural come to me. Why does it say it in the singular? Why is it in the singular? So listen to this amazing Chiddush Aharon by the owner of the, I think it's called Ma'adane Zahav. Might as well promote it. Nobody has to ship me dips from Ma'adane Zahav next week in the mail. But he said the following Chiddush Aharon. Chiddush Aharon says that we know this was Har Sinai. And Har Sinai is characterized the slogan of our shul, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad. It should have said Vayachanu in the plural, they in the plural, and camped it says Vayichan in the one and singular. Why? They were with one heart. They were one people. Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad. Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad. As opposed to the Egyptians who were B'Lev Echad Ki Ish Echad, who had one similar goal, but they had nothing else connecting them. We were connected interpersonally. We were one organic whole. We were one unit, one family, one nation, one people, aside from the shared agenda that we had, but we felt so connected. So the Chiddush Aharon says, you know, when you are disparate, when you are separate, when you are a conglomerate of people, but really individuals and apart, when you have a financial dispute or a conflict, it's an adversarial relationship. I claim I paid you. You said I never paid you back. I claim you owe me for the damages. You say it's my fault. My ox is the one who gored. So if there's an adversarial relationship, then we're going to come in with a great sense of conflict. But when we come in, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad, so there's no adversarial relationship. We simply have a Shiloh. And the same way, if a person goes to ask the Shiloh, I found the milchik fork in the fleshik dishwasher, what's the halacha? What's the halacha on the skashers? What's the halacha on the Shabbos? You just go and you ask a Shiloh. What Moshe was saying is the people feel so close and so connected and so united and so unified, they come as one to just find out what's the answer. Why? Because if you're going to a secular court, if you're going to a civil court, and you're having a fight, you think the judge was unfair, and the jury didn't really hear you, and your argument is more persuasive, is more compelling. But when you go to a Jewish court, when you hear the Jewish psak, when you employ Parshas Mishpatim, this is not just individuals, human, finite, fallible people who've come up with the best they can for a social contract and a moral and social society. This is the word and the will of Hashem, the creator of the universe, the infinite and omnipotent. He's told us. Here are the rules. Here's how to navigate. Here's how to get to the truth. Here's how to get to what is the most just and the most accurate and the most correct. So, therefore, said Moshe to Yisro, when they don't come as adversaries. They come as brothers. They come as one family asking a psak, what is Hashem's will? What is His vision when it comes in such a situation, when it comes to such a conflict? So we have to remember that. When we're learning Baba Kama, Baba Metziah, Baba Batzra, when we're memorizing the Lama Tetz Balachos, when we're memorizing the names of the Parshios, when we're making our way through all the names and places of Tanakh, when we're testing our children and memorizing or pouring countless hours in a base medrash, we have to remember that what we're doing is a window into the will of Hashem. We are understanding His Ratzon for how the world should work. This is the Emes. The Gemara in the beginning of Sanhedrin talks about Hadon Din Emes La'amito. That a judge's responsibility is to be done din emes la'amito, is to not only come to the correct conclusion, but come to the correct conclusion for the correct reason. that the person shouldn't just conclude that because it makes sense to them. Because you know what happens in a society where, a society of relativism and subjectivism, where judges and lawmakers and legislators can legislate law based on what makes sense to them? You can get a Nazi Germany was democratically elected. Hitler was democratically elected. A corrupt, morally depraved society can come to morally corrupt conclusions if one thinks that laws are arrived at democratically. Now, of course, we embrace our democratic system, and it's brilliant. It's the best in history, and we love it, and we live by it, and our lives are better for it here in America. But religiously, what the Torah is teaching us is the Torah's laws are not democratically elected. These are the will of Hashem. And ve'ela ha-mishpatim, what's connecting us back to Har Sinai into civil tort, criminal law, laws of damages and financial disputes, is that they too are the will of Hashem. Essentially, they too are a religious experience in the way that we live and the way that we go out. Okay, let's go. With that introduction to Parshas Mishpatim, we have many of the laws. We all know the law of the Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri is a fascinating law. The Eved Ivri is a fascinating law. You know, today we have, in our secular society, we have police blotters. We have police frequencies. We have people who somehow get some sort of a disturbed geschmack by every day going on the internet to look who was arrested in their zip code the day before. Maybe it'll be someone they know, and then they'll have great information, and they can be the first to tell someone else and text and tweet and post and humiliate the person whose mugshot appears on a police blotter. I know as the rabbi, because I always get the emails from such wonderful, virtuous people who say, "Rabbi, I thought you probably should know, so-and-so was arrested last night." Thank you so much. Noble responsibility indeed. The Torah, Revolba points out, is exactly the opposite. The Torah tells that a person who stole from another, pay back. Pay back, make them whole, do tshuva, and nobody needs to know. We're not going to hang your name in the post office, your face. We're not sending out a mass email. We're not posting it online. Pay back, compensate the person from whom you stole, do tshuva, rehabilitate yourself, and we all move on. And it's only when that person can't, that's when their soul doesn't ivri ivri. That's when the only way that they can arrive at the funds to be able to compensate is by selling themselves as a slave. But if they can afford it, we enable them to do tshuva, to repair the damage they had done, without seeking to publicly humiliate. Because our system is not punitive in nature, it's rehabilitative. It's a goal to make a person better, to help them recover, and to help them come back. What happens when the person says they want to stay? So we know that we give them a earring on the ear. We put a hole in there. We put a hole in their ear. So in this context, the pasuk says the following: "V'yigishu Adonav al Elokim, v'yigishu al Adas al Mezuzah, v'ratz Adonav al Sosnav Matzev Avadol la'olam." We bring him to court, Elohim. We bring him to the judges, and we put him next to the door, next to the doorpost, and we put a hole right in his ear, and v'avadol la'olam, and now he's enslaved for good. Now he's enslaved for good. So, Revolba says the following. If you look at Rashi, Rashi of course tells us, why don't we put a tattoo on his forehead? Thief! Robber! Lowlife! Oisvarf! We wouldn't know how to spell Oisvarf. That's why we don't tattoo it. Instead, we give an earring. We pierce his ear. Why is the ear chosen? Everybody knows Rashi. Rashi tells us, Yachashtem says a chair to Allah. I'm on page 418, Parachaval of Pasuk Vav. Hayimani says right ear. O Eino Ella small. Tamalomar Ozan Lexer Shava. Never come outside and says, Dovanama Mitzora. So we have Xer Shava from the case of Mitzora. Omar Biochan Ben Zakai. Ozan Zosha Shama al Arsinai lo Signov. This ear that heard at Arsinai, don't steal. Vahal Viganov. You were at Arsinai. God himself spoke. Unparalleled revelation, and God said, don't steal. And what do you go and do? You steal. So what happens? That same ear that heard and wasn't listening, Tirza, we pierce the ear. I saw, Rashi is quoting the Gemara Kedushin that says this. So the Kedusha Arim, the Ger Rebbe says, but which part of the ear do we pierce? We pierce the ear lobe. What function does the ear lobe have? Gornished, it dangles there so that you could hang jewelry off of it. It dangles. You have something to play with when you're bored in class. It dangles there. Who knows? If you really want to send a message, that the ear that you have that should have heard the message, that ear wasn't listening. You know what we should do? I don't know, make a loud sonic boom in your ear and make you lose your hearing in that ear. We should stick something into the ear. Clog up the ear canal, because you didn't listen, you don't deserve to. Something about the ear. Why do we do the ear lobes? You know what the Chiddush Harim says? What happened between when we were at Har Sinai? And we heard in Har Sinai, don't steal. And yet, then he went and he stole anyway. What happened in between? I'm sure standing at Har Sinai, everyone said, of steal. Me, of course, not terrible. Pasnish, never. And then between hearing don't steal and making a personal commitment, I would never steal. And then he stole. What happened in between? So the Chiddush Harim says, you know what happened in between? You hung out with a bunch of leitzanim and rikanim. You hang out with a bunch of cynics and scoffers and doubters. And you hang out with materialistic, money-hungry, grubby people, greedy people. All they talked about was money. And the society that you surrounded yourself with and the conversations at the Shabbos table that you attended put this incredible pressure on you. Got to drive that car and make that wedding and wear these gowns and have this outfit and do the thing and go on that vacation and go to, and all of a sudden you have this enormous pressure to keep up with everyone around you and to do whatever it takes in order to be able to provide and do that, and you started cutting corners. And now you fill out your taxes dishonestly, and maybe in your business partnership you cut corners and didn't report everything that needed to be reported. So what happened is we were all at Har Sinai and we heard those signals of don't steal, and we all said, steal, of course not, never, not me. But then we listened to things. We listened to messages and values. We listened and absorbed a culture whose priorities were skewed. And then what happened, lo and behold, the person stole in order to keep up. Says the Chiddush HaRim, what should you have done instead? So he references the Gemara. The Gemara Ksubas Daf Hey tells us, why Taka is the earlobe there? Why do we have an earlobe, the Gemara there in Ksubas wonders? The whole ear is hard, it's made out of cartilage. The ear is made out of cartilage, and all of a sudden you have the earlobe nice and soft. What's it doing there? So the Gemara Ksubas says, you know what it's doing there? It's there for you to fold up and put in your ear when you're around someone who's saying the wrong thing. Lashon Hara, materialism, skewed priorities. This is not like a cute vort that your kindergartner came home with for the Parsha. I'm telling you, a Gemara in Ksubas Daf Hey. This is a Maimar Chazal. The Gemara in Ksubas Daf Hey says, why is the bottom of the ear soft? So that you can fold it over and put it in your ear to not hear and to not absorb the wrong values, the wrong messages. And that's what this Eved should have done. It's a great insight by the Chiddush HaRim. So essentially the Chiddush HaRim says, what happened in between? Har Sinai, don't steal. So yeah, of course, don't steal. And then he went still. You know what happened? You heard the wrong things. You listened to the wrong things. You found yourself in the wrong places. You found yourself following and listening to the wrong values and the wrong priorities. And you should have turned your ear up, whether literally or figuratively, you should have clogged your ears to not hear the wrong messages. But Avoda focuses on a different, the Gemara gives a second. On the one hand, it says the ear that heard at Har Sinai, don't steal, and went and stole. That's the Ger Rebbe. Revoba focuses on the other statement of the Gemara. The ear that heard at Har Sinai, what? Heard at Mitzrayim. Avadahem, velo avadim la avadim. God says, you're avadim to me. The only one you serve is me. The only master to whom you owe your time, your resources, your energy, your productivity is me. Avadahem v'lo avadim la avadim. And he goes out and does what? Makes himself a permanent eved to a human being? So God says, we pierce the ear. Says Rav Volba, the essence of Torah is freedom. It sounds counterintuitive because our lives are so highly regulated and legislated that you'd say freedom. Freedom is I could eat whatever I want. Freedom is I can spend Shabbos however I want. Freedom is I can go and say and do and watch and listen to whatever I want. Instead, from when I woke up in the morning, I was told how to wash my hands. The first words have to be on my lips. The order to tie my shoes. And that before I started my day, I have no freedom. I can't even decide what order to put my own shoes on. And you're telling me the Torah provides freedom? And the answer is yes. The Torah is the essence of freedom. Because when we have the omnipotent, infinite, one and only Ribono Shel Olam, we have the God, the master of the universe, the creator of this world, the creator of all of us in it, who knows what provides the most meaning and satisfaction and fulfillment, which gives us the greatest and most lasting joy and happiness. When we follow His prescription for our life, it frees us. It liberates us. It gives us the courage and the strength to not be enslaved to anything or anyone else around us. Rav Volbe writes, and when Rav Volbe would make the bracha in the morning, Shalom Asani Eved, that God did not make me an Eved. You know what he had in mind? I'm so grateful that I'm not a person who's obsessed with what others think of me. That I don't conform my life to what the fashion magazines or pop culture or society or my neighbor make me need to conform to be. Shalom Asani Eved, Rav Volbe's Kavana, and I'm offering you, this is a post-sitter snippet on Shalom Asani Eved. We're going to do another sitter snippet later. But Shalom Asani Eved, where Rav Volbe's Kavana was, thank God, it's not that I didn't grow up on a plantation, and thank God I wasn't enslaved in the Warsaw Ghetto. His imagery of Shalom Asani Eved, that he made that bracha every single morning, was not thank you for not making me a physical slave in physical bondage and servitude, but Shalom Asani Eved, thank you for not making me enslaved to what society says I have to dress and listen to, where I have to go, how I have to be, how I have to think. Thank you for giving me a system of Torah. Thank you for empowering me with a divine plan for how to think and be and say and dress and where to go and what to be. That's what it means. That's what it means, Shalom Asani Eved. And that's why the Eved says, Avada Him V'lo Avadim Avadim. Hashem says, if you can fully submit to be an Eved to me, you'll never have to think you're an Eved to anyone else. To anyone else. Your boss is mistreating you, you feel threatened, you have a conflict between what your boss is telling you, what's morally correct. If you're an Eved to Hashem, you have no conflict. It doesn't mean it'll be easy going, but it means you never have a dilemma. You don't have a conflict. It's the ultimate liberation. Hashem is the ultimate liberator, because by our submitting to Him, it's like the Rav's insight in Al HaTshuva, the conversation with the psychologist who said, why do we daven to be afraid? And the Rav said, fear is good. He said, what do you mean? I make a whole living by trying to help people conquer their fears. And the Rav said, yes, there's one great fear, that if you can live with that one great fear, you will have no lesser fear ever. If we can live with a Yirah Shemayim of Hashem, then you never have to be afraid of heights and illness, afraid of financial collapse, afraid of public speaking, afraid of... You never have anything to fear. Work on the one big fear, Yirah Shemayim, you never have to have any other small fear. Work on being an Eved Hashem, Ana Avda Dekud Shebrichu, Hashem, I'm an Eved just to you, in every circumstance, in every moment. Whether you're shopping for clothing, choosing where to go on vacation, choosing how to conduct your business, choosing what to look at next on the internet, ask yourself, I'm an Eved to Hashem, what does my Adon, what does my Master want? And if that's a consideration I have, it's the only consideration I need. What's ethical, what's moral, what's just, what's right? What will give him nachas ruach? What will make him proud? Avadayim v'lo avadim la'avadim. If we can submit ourselves as avadim just to Him, we never have to worry that anyone else can ever be a master over us. And we saw that in extraordinary ways. Whether it's those in the Holocaust who were physically in bondage and imprisoned, but nevertheless remained avadim only to Hashem, therefore no one else could own them, even as limited as they were. We saw it in the heroes of the Soviet Jewry movement, who were enslaved but maintained and preserved their own identity as avadim to Hashem, and in that way were able to triumph and survive and transcend whatever the servitude that others were seeking to impose on them. It's an amazing, amazing insight. So this notion of the Eved Ivri, we had the Chidush Arim, who told us about the ear. Clog your ear. Don't listen to the things. Because even though we start with the best intentions, we were all at our Sinai. And there we pledged and promised to do everything right and to be perfect. And we could never imagine struggling or doing it wrong. And then we expose ourselves to ideas and thoughts and people and influences. And all of a sudden we find ourselves after the fact having violated things that we never ever dreamt we were capable of doing. And the way to stop ourselves in between, that's the message of the Eved and the piercing of the ear, is be careful. The ear is the entranceway. Be careful. That'll mold and shape who we are and the inside of Rav Volbe. Let's move on. Perek Chaval of Pasuk Yud. Torah tells us the following. We have the din of the Amma of Ivriya, of the female slave, and the lachas that govern how she's treated and with whom she's matched. Im levno yi'adena ki mishpat abanos yaseh la. Pasuk Tes. If he's designated her for his son, it's quite a shidduch, he should deal with her according to the rights of young women. Im acheres yikach la. But if he shall take another in addition to her, he should not diminish, he should not deprive her. This is the halachic source for for the marital rights that a woman has. This is what's included in the Ksuba. The Ksuba is a one-way document. For anyone who feels that Judaism is somehow a misogynistic or biased religion against women, the man does not get a document. The Masada Kedushin does not get to go to the Shmorg. He's stuck at the Chassan's Tish, where they have some like bad rice and whatever else, few little things, the hard pound cake and the fake Diet Coke and clear pitchers and whatever else they're serving at the Chassan's Tish, while everyone else is fressing at the limitless sushi and whatever other delicacies. The Masada Kedushin, he's stuck at the Chassan's Tish. He doesn't get to go to the Kabbalah Sepanim to visit the Kala, to make a Kinyan Sudur with her, that she says some document that she's going to pledge, that she's going to, her responsibilities. Anyone who thinks it's biased or misogynist, biased, it is true. It's 100% biased, it's just in the other direction. So the Ksuba contains the responsibility. Now, I'm joking, half joking, but why was it done that way? So there's a big machlokas, the Ksuba Daraisa, the Rabbanan. We assume it's the Rabbanan, it's rabbinic in nature. And when was the Ksuba instituted? It was instituted nearly 2,000 years ago. And I promise you that in Babylonia 2,000 years ago, there was no feminist movement that was pushing the rabbis to come up with a document to protect women, to preserve their dignity, and to protect their income and their lifestyle. It was not done in response, and it's not a form of apologetics. It's because our religion has always concerned itself with the dignity of women, of wives, of mothers, of responsibility for how we treat and take care, and to protect them. And that's what Ksuba did. You have to understand that before the Ksuba, biblically, a man could be married to more than one woman, if he could survive that. So he'd be married to more than one woman. The Rambam said, I've been up since 4 o'clock. I've jet lagged. So I'm not responsible for anything I say. So the Rambam writes, you can only be married to more than one woman, even biblically speaking, and even Sfarim, who did not accept the Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom, can only be married to more than one woman. Polygamy, if he can treat each woman as if they were his own wife, meaning he could provide sher ksus va'ona to each wife. If being married to many would deplete his resources, his time, his energy, his love, then he was forbidden, biblically forbidden, to be married to more than one. The prerequisite to be married to more than one is to be able to provide that for each one. So in that society, what happened? A man would get in a fight with one wife and he'd say, I'm moving on. You're not the way you picture in the resume. It was clearly Photoshopped. That's not who you are. And I don't like this fight. And the food is not as good as your mother's, even though you told me you were as good a cook as your mother. And therefore, I'm out of here. So what would he do? He had 8 other wives to go to. And now what did she do? What did she do? Who was providing for her? In antiquity, women did not have opportunities in the workplace and to draw their own income. So what was she supposed to do in order to keep a roof over her head or food on her table? He didn't give her a get, he'd have responsibilities through the get. He would just move on. He'd leave her there, suspended. So the Torah instituted this ksuba. When he gives the get, in the event of his demise or the dissolution of the marriage, he has financial obligations and responsibilities. This was not a form of apologetics. It was not responding to any ism in society. This was the Torah, lechatchila, a priori, concerning itself. Our rabbis have always, and still always, and will always, concern themselves trying to implement what they think is the Ratzon Hashem, Hashem's view and vision for how to set up the world. Anyway, so this is our pasuk. She'irak susava onasa. What are these three things? You should not diminish her food, her clothing, or intimacy, the responsibility of a marital relationship. And these are the components that are contained within the ksuba. And I just want to make this point quickly because I really want to move on to the main part, what I want to share with you in Parshas Mishpatim this morning. But in the Rabbi Soloveitchik Chumash, he talks about, he doesn't use this word because there wasn't a hashtag movement in his time, but he talks about the importance of consent. And now the Torah, really ahead of its time, was very concerned that in a relationship of intimacy, in physical affection, that there has to be respect and there has to be consent. And he writes, Judaism does not overlook or underestimate the physical aspects of marriage. On the contrary, once sacrificial withdrawal from the sinful erotic paradise of change and variety is completed, the natural element of marriage comes to the fore. The two partners owe each other not only fidelity, but they also owe each other full gratification of their needs. Refusal or failure by one of the partners to satisfy this conjugal right of the other is sufficient reason for divorce. Each one must observe these laws with regard to the other. The marriage must not be converted into an exclusively spiritual fellowship. Marriage without carnal enjoyment and love is contrary to human nature and is to be dissolved. The ethic of marriage is hedonistic, not monastic. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating insight. What the Rav is saying is that the ultimate description of marriage is not one in which either of the partners can say to the other, what do you want that physical affection and connection for? What are you, an animal? What are you, a pig? I heard about you. It said on your resume that you love Torah, that you zug Tehillim and say Tzen Arana all day, that you're sitting in the base medrash all night, that you're volunteering and doing chesed, and now you crave this animalistic experience? It's a mekachtos. What kind of low-life animal pig are you? Said the Rav, the person who takes that attitude, who comes with that perspective, they're the one who's wrong. They're the one who's wrong. The party who comes recognizing and respecting their own human, natural, internal need and seeking to have an outlet for it in a holy context, namely with a person at a time, in a place, in a way, in a manner that's elevating, is transforming the animal instinct, which is natural within anyone, everyone, and elevating it to be able to be holy. You know, the Rav doesn't say this here, but the pasuk later in the parasha says, Anshei Kodesh Tiyunli. Hashem says, be men of sanctity, of holiness. Not men, be generic. Be people. Anshei Kodesh. Be holy people. And the Kotzke Rebbe, Zchus Yagen Aleinu, says, it doesn't say, Malachi Kodesh Tiyunli. It doesn't say, be holy angels for me. Be holy angels. You should strive to be angelic. There are other religions who depict holiness as abstinence. How do you become holy? A vow of celibacy, a vow of silence, a vow of fasting. By withdrawing from the physical world is the only way that you can achieve holiness. And we come and say, no, the Torah doesn't say Malachi Kodesh Tiyunli. It doesn't say try to be angelic. You know what happens when you try to be angelic? You have scandals and lawsuits. And when you deny your own human need and craving and pretend that you can suppress it indefinitely, you get scandals and lawsuits and challenges. Not everybody, but a lot of it. And no one should be surprised. The Torah says, the Kotzker says, Anshei Kodesh Tiyunli. You're human beings. And Hashem says, nobody knows you better than me. I designed you. I programmed you. I built you. And despite being Anshei, despite being people with human needs and cravings and failures and imperfections, despite being Anashem, Anshei, Kodesh, you're still capable of holiness. And that is Sheirak Susava Unasa. When one of the parties craves physical intimacy, a connection, affection, they're not the one who is in the worst position. Well, what happened? Did you not have a good year in Israel? You weren't inspired? You didn't flip out? You didn't realize that that's for the pigs and the animals and the movie stars and the secular culture and the non-Jews? That we should... No, we're not Malachim. That is for us. It's who we're meant to be and how we're meant to behave. And it's part of the marital contract. And whichever partner in the marriage tries to deny and deprive the other partner of that very basic human need, they lose out. The Torah dissolves such a marriage. The Torah dissolves such a marriage. And that person loses out. The rights which are mentioned in the Torah have to be complied with by every husband in accordance with his physical capacity and occupation. The wife... The wife may prevent the husband from taking extended business trips which interfere with his responsibility to be at home. He may leave town only if she permits him to do so. She may also even ask him for changing trades should the change result in less frequent. Withholding of these rights is forbidden. Forbidden. Sheirak susava onasa. Not only material things, the ksuba actually spells out that the husband is obligated to provide for his wife according to the manner in which she is used to and which she was raised. So, more than the picture on the resume, look for the zip code. On the resume. Sheirak susa va'onasa. Onasa, that word ona, which we use to describe cohabitation, really means time. It's about giving time and being fully present in that time. Being fully present in that time. Withholding these rights is forbidden. In case of illness or incapacitation, a waiting period of 6 months is granted. About the conclusion of the period, the condition of the husband does not improve. He must either obtain her consent or divorce her and pay her the value of the ksuba. If he's not able to comply with time or physically, and he can't provide that need, that very legitimate, basic human need, then he's obligated to divorce her and must pay the ksuba. And there's another interesting law in the other direction, which is, what if a woman refuses to participate or provide for that basic human need? The Torah has a name for her. She's called a moredes. A moredes means a rebellious wife. And Beis Din asks her, why are you moredes? Why are you being rebellious? Your husband says that you're never intimate, you're never affectionate. Why? So if she says, I don't like him, and it's impossible for me, there's no attraction, and in fact, I'm repulsed by him. So Beis Din forces him to divorce her. Why? Listen to the Lashon of the Rambam. For a wife is not a prisoner, such that she must consort with a person whom she despises. A wife is not a prisoner that we make her cohabit with someone she despises. There has to be consent. But there is a responsibility in both directions. Which is fascinating. That means the physical component of a couple being together has a spiritual result, which is much more than just its pragmatic or practical conclusion. The whole issue with halacha of birth control is a complicated area of birth control. But these halachas remain in force even when birth control is not relevant. The halachic responsibility of a husband to a wife and a wife to a husband to not be a moredes are true in a case that cannot result in reproduction, in conception. If a woman is pregnant, and if a woman is on birth control, and if a woman is postmenopausal, and all these circumstances where it's not just the practical or pragmatic result that one is seeking, but it is the process. It is the relationship, it's the union which the Torah is endorsing as well. So in this short section, in this one pasuk, Macheres Yikachla She'erek Suzva Ona Sa She'erek Suzva Ona, there is really the ethic of marriage, a Jewish attitude towards physical intimacy, towards marriage, towards relationships, the importance of consent, the mutual relationship in both directions, the Torah absolutely rejecting any notion that one can coerce the other, that there has to be a foundation of love and of consent and so on. Okay, let's go on. Perchav Veis Pasuk Vav. And I want to look at Rashi and Ramban inside, because I promised to get back to looking at Mefarshim inside. So Mirtz Hashem, we're going to do that today. Torah goes on, there's a long list, we're not going to review them right now. Manslaughter, killing a slave, bodily injury, what you owe the person. Rak Shifto Yitain V'Rapo Yirapay. Where's that Pasuk? The five things that you owe a person, pasuk yites. V'nikam hakarak shivto yitain v'rapo yirapei. I had to tell you one Imre Chaim. I have to tell you one Imre Chaim. So he says the following: the Vishnitzer. What is the Vishnitzer? How does he interpret every pasuk? What do I always tell you? For many of the Chassidish Rebbes, everything comes back to Shabbos. So he says v'rak shivto yitain v'rapo yirapei. You know how rapo yirapei? Shifto yitain. Now the pasuk here is not talking about Shabbos. Shifto yitain is Sheves. What is Sheves? From the same word as Shabbos, it means he's rest, he's still. He can't go to work. So you got to pay workman's comp. You damaged him. You incapacitated him. He's debilitated. He can't go to work. He can't earn an income. How is he supposed to live? Shifto yitain. You have to pay to cover the cost of lost wages. That's what the pasuk literally means. But the Vishnitzer says, no, v'rapo yirapei. You know how any one of us heal? We're injured in life. We're injured by people. We're injured by circumstances. We're injured by life. And v'rapo yirapei, you know how you heal? You know how we find the strength to heal in life? Shifto yitain, Shabbos. Shifto, our Shabbos. We need our Shabbos. We need our Shabbos. If 1 week ran into the next week, and we never had Shabbos, Shabbos to eat and sing Zmiros and exchange Divrei Torah. Shabbos to host and be hosted. Shabbos to shluff and to sleep. Shabbos to come to shul. Shabbos to disconnect from the universe. If we didn't have Shabbos, we could never rapo yirapei. So the Vishnitzer says, Rak shivto yitain. Give us shivto, our Shabbos. Give me my Shabbos. Rapo yirapei, and then I can bear anything. Then I can come back from anything. And then I can heal anything. Beautiful Vishnitzer. Okay. Death caused by an animal. These are the Arba Avos Nezikin. You can't dig the pit. Property that damages. Payment of theft. Perichav Beis Pasuk Vav. Pasuk says the following: Kitein Yisha Re'eo Kesav Okelim L'Shmor V'Gunav Mi Beis Ta'ishim Metzeh Ganav Yisholim Shnayim. A person steals from someone else, and you find the thief. They have to pay back. How much do they have to pay back? Twice as much. They have to pay back Kefal. They have to pay back Kefal. So, says the Rav, very interesting here. Is this the right pasuk? Sorry, one second. Sorry. Pasuk Vav. Hold on. Perichav Beis Pasuk Vav. They switched it. Machamash. Just joking. Yeah, no, sorry. That's the Pasuk. Yeah, yeah. Same path. They didn't switch it. You could exhale. Kitei Nishereo Kesev Okeilin Lishmor. You gave someone something Lishmor to watch over. These are the source, the rule, the Dalet Shomer. We have four types of people who guard, stewards for someone else's property. And the level of responsibility and accountability you have is directly proportional to the compensation or reward you get. So for example, the highest level is a Shomer Sachar, someone who's getting paid to watch. If I'm paying you to watch it, then you're going to have the highest level of responsibility. I don't care if, someone stole it. I don't care if someone... Then you have Shomer Chinam, somebody who watches something for free. Then you have a Shoal, you have someone who borrows something. And a Socher, somebody who rents something. Right? So you have the four different types of Shomer. So Rasalovichik here points out the following. Oh. All of man's talents, endowments, and qualities, his very personality, are owned by God. Man's activities must therefore be in conformity with the will of Hashem. Man's body and soul are governed by the general rule articulated with respect to deposits of personal property. All of one's activities must therefore conform with the directness of the depositor. Where the Torah here says, Kitei Yishareyeh, you give someone to watch, they have responsibility. Hashem gives us to watch. He gives us our body to watch. He gives us ourselves to watch. Yom Kippur, man finds himself in a situation analogous to that described in the next pasuk. A man must convince God that he has not misappropriated the deposit. Right? Because here you have in the very next pasuk, Torah says, what happens? You don't find the thief. So the owner who asked you to guard the property comes to the judge and makes you swear that you didn't in fact use it. You weren't negligent about it. So the Rav says in the analogy, that's what happens when we come on Yom Kippur. We say, Hashem, I know you gave me to safeguard my body and my soul. I in fact was not negligent. And that's what we say in the conclusion of Ne'ilah. Laman nechtal me'oshak yadenu. Yom Kippur was bestowed upon us, so we cease from misappropriating our very selves. Any chait committed by a person constitutes larceny, theft from God. We are the shomer. We have been given ourselves to watch. We've been given everything we have to watch. If we misuse our home, our car, our resources, our talents, our skills, our qualities, our opportunities, if we misuse them or squander them, we are like the shomer who has been negligent and lost the item that they were entrusted to steward, to safeguard, to be in charge of. It's a form of stealing from Hashem. But here's what I wanted to share with you, and you bear with me a couple more minutes today. The Rav goes on and he quotes the story of Rav Meir and his wife Bruria, who were parents of two twin boys who died of an extended illness over one Shabbos. Through the Shabbos, Bruria did not tell her husband, Rav Meir, of the tragedy. She didn't want to compromise his Shabbos. But when the day ended, Bruria had to convey the terrible news to her husband. So after Havdalah, she told the following parable to Rav Meir. This is all in the Medrash and Mishlei, it's in the Gemara too. And she did it in the form of a halacha question. She said to her husband, the great Tana Rav Meir, some time ago a certain man came and left two diamonds in my trust. A pikadon, I was the shomer, I was in charge of them. And now he's called for them. Should I give them back or not? So Rav Meir looked at his wife, Bruria, who was more brilliant in some ways than he. Gemara tells us, we did a whole class in the people of the book on Bruria. And he looked, of course, somebody gave you something to watch, it really belongs to them. And the term of your watching it has concluded, of course you have to give it back. So that's when Bria said, Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us our two sons to watch, and our term of being a shomer over them, our term of being their steward has concluded. And as painful as it is, and as badly as we don't want to, we have no choice, but it's time to give them back. And as moving as the story is, the halakha question posed by Bria seems trivial. Was there any doubt that the owner of the diamonds had the right to be taken to take them back? The answer is so obvious that her question seems superfluous. Why would Bria ask her husband for a ruling in such a simple case of Jewish law? So Rabbi Soloveitchik says the following. Perhaps you have to interpret the parable by interpolating additional details into the analogy. A mysterious stranger, his face hidden behind a dark cloak, knocks at Bria's door. She opens the door. The stranger silently thrusts a small box into her hands and vanishes into the night. The puzzled Bria opens the box and is startled to find two beautiful diamonds. She wonders, did the stranger intend to place the diamonds in her trust for safekeeping? Perhaps they were an outright gift. Bria resolves to wait a few weeks to see if the stranger returns. She meticulously takes care of the diamonds in accordance with all the applicable laws of Pikadon as she waits for the stranger to return. Weeks, months, years pass, and the stranger has not reappeared. Bria thinks to herself that maybe the stranger is no longer alive. Perhaps he indeed meant to give her the diamonds as an outright gift. But one fateful Shabbos years later, Bria is startled to again hear a knock on the door. Hurriedly donning her robe, Buria answers the door. The mysterious stranger with the hidden face in his back. He grabs the diamonds from her hands, and once again he quickly and silently disappears. This is the story Buria told Reb Meir. Unlike a normal pikadon where an item is held in safekeeping for a specific period of time, as prescribed by the owner, the period of safekeeping for God's pikadon is open-ended. He is the hidden stranger who thrusts upon man all sorts of items of value, money, honor, health, wisdom, children. His face is obscured and he says nothing. And we often make Buria's mistake. We begin to think of God's pikadon as a gift. Only later, and often under tragic circumstances, are we forced to confront the fact that Hashem does not give us these items outright. They are only entrusted to us for safekeeping. If we guard them properly, Hashem may allow us to keep them longer. If, on the other hand, we do not acknowledge Hashem as the owner of the pikadon, He may come and claim them even sooner. It's an entirely different way to view. I don't want to apply it to children. So painful, I won't even go there. But property. We have items and things that we've lost. And we wonder, how could it be that we lost what was ours, but that was our mistake, was to begin with, talking about property. I would not do this, though the Rav does, and family. It's all on loan. It's never part of our permanent collection. We're lucky and should be grateful for whatever time that we have with those things. Again, I'm talking about things. And it's a different mentality. Not that I'm the Baal, not that I'm the Bailam, the owner of what I have. I am the Shomer. I'm simply the watch person, the steward, who's watching over and protecting what I have. Okay, Parshas Mishpatim is replete, but I want to finish with one more thing, which is really the major thing that I wanted to share with you. Perichav Beis, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. And here I want to contrast two different laws. I have 5 more minutes. And here I want to contrast two different laws. I have as long as I want, but you'll only tolerate 5 more minutes. Perichav Beis, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Page 430 in the Arutz Gerol Stone Chumash. And the Torah tells us the following. V'ger lo sonev lo sachatzenu, kigeir ma'isim be'eretz Mitzrayim. A very, very important law about how we treat strangers, people who come from the outside, who immigrate, I'm not making a political statement, but we as Jewish people, the mitzvah and the Torah repeated more than any other, is our responsibility because of our own personal experience, knowing where we came from, that should guide and inform how we responsibly approach these things going forward. Kol amanavi asom lo sa'anun, pasuk chavalef. You're not allowed to cause pain. You can't aggravate or aggrieve a widow or an orphan. And the Torah goes in an unusual departure. And here the Torah tells us, Imanesa aneoso. You know what's going to happen if you do? Don't you dare cause pain to a widow or an orphan. Don't you dare aggravate them. Why? If you do, Kim tsaoki tsakelai, shamoa eshma tsaaka. So, if they call out and cry to me, I will surely hear their cries. And you know what's going to happen? V'chara api v'harakti eschem b'charev. God says, I have no tolerance. I have a zero tolerance policy for people who mistreat the vulnerable. I have a zero tolerance policy for somebody who aggrieves, who aggravates, who mistreats the widow or orphan. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pay you back. Your wives will be widows and your children will be orphans because if you can't feel sympathy and empathy and support for someone who's gone through that and that's the way you treat them, your spouse and your children will know exactly what it feels. Now it's fascinating. First, again, it's amazing. The Torah here goes out of its way to tell us how Hashem is going to feel about your behavior, and what Hashem is going to do as a result of your behavior, and the punishment that will come as a consequence. All of these are really strict, strong, startling departures from the normal way. But there's something else that's unusual, and that is the double language. Imanesa aneoso, if you aggravate, sa'uk yitzak, and they cry out, shamoa eshma. It's like Hashem all of a sudden gets a stutter. Everything is double words. Anessa anet, sa'uk yitzak, shamoa eshma. Just cut out 3 words there. Simplify the pasuk. Consolidate the pasuk. What's going on? So the Kutzker Rebbe says something unbelievable. Kutzker Rebbe says, you know why the double language? Because every time you aggravate the widow or the orphan, you're not only mistreating them in the way that you mistreat them, but they are reminded that they are a widow or an orphan. They're going through that experience of when they became the widow or the orphan all over again. You took advantage of them, you were cruel to them, you were harsh, you were callous. You wronged them. Not only did you wrong them in the specific thing that you wronged them with, but when they are wronged, they can't help but relive and revisit their experience of what put them in that circumstance to begin with, and therefore everything is a double language. Anessa ane. You're not just wronging them with the one way, ane, ane, se ane. You're also reviving the whole pain and the loss of being the Yasam V'Almana. Tzauk Yitzak. And when they cry out to me, says God, they're not just going to cry out in response to the particular way that you've heard them. They're going to cry out also about the bigger, broader picture of what they're going through. And Shamoa Eshma, not only will I listen to and respond to how they were wronged in the particular way, but I'll also, says God, respond to and listen to how they were wronged in the bigger, broader fashion as well. That's why the double language. But now fast forward for a minute and look at the next law. Very interesting. When you lend money, you cannot charge them interest and you cannot press them for the money. If you take a garment as security, you take collateral from the person, then only until sunset you have to give it back. So what's going to happen? Some person is going to borrow money from you. And when they borrow money from you, you're going to hold collateral. What are you going to take as collateral? You're going to take their pajamas. So they go home to sleep that night. What do they have to sleep in? You have their pajamas. You gave it a collateral. So when they ask for it, says Hashem, you better give it. You know why? Because if you don't give it, and they cry out to me that they had nothing to sleep in, because you held on to that collateral and you didn't give it back, the shamati, I'm going to listen to them. And here he doesn't say, I'm going to listen to them and I'm going to make your family poor and I'm going to make you rely on a loan and I'm going to make you know what it's like to not have pajamas at night. He says, why am I going to listen? Ki chanun ani, because I'm chanun. It's incongruous. If these laws, there should be a parallel in the law. If Hashem pays you back, mida kemegen mida, so he should pay you back. That's A. But B, there's something very unjust about this law. I, let's say, have the money. And you come and you need to borrow money. And I say to you, look, I want to lend you money, but I also have to be responsible to my family. How do I know I'm ever going to get that money back? The only way I can lend you money is if you give me what? Collateral. When do you get collateral back? When you pay the loan. And here the Torah is saying, even though the poor person has not paid the loan, but they need their pajamas. They need the collateral. And God says, and if you don't give them the collateral, you're the wrong. What do you mean I'm the wrong? I should have never lent them to begin with. Then I wouldn't be in this position that I'm being criticized and judged, that I was unwilling to give them back the collateral. The whole reason to have collateral is to secure the loan. So why is the other person entitled to get their collateral back and I'm judged and criticized when I don't give it back? And Hashem says I'm going to hear their cries? And kichanun ani? What's going on over here? So, open your Mikros Gedolos, if you have one, very quickly. And the Rashbam is clearly bothered by this. And the Rashbam writes, Afa bisham in adin yesh lamashkon, ve'eno chayv lachziro, el lefnim mishiris adin. Really, the lender is entitled to hold the collateral. That's the whole reason for collateral. And giving it back is only lefnim mishiris adin. It's going the extra mile. Ve'lo hayol in l'shmo atza'akaso. And Hashem says, I never really should have heard the cry of the naked borrower, the cold borrower who wants his pajamas back. I should have said, tough noogies, you gave the collateral, the lender's entitled to keep it. But imlo mipnei sherachum dechanun ani, says Hashem, when I hear the cry, when I hear the genuine and authentic plea of someone who needs something, even when it's illogical, I can't help but respond. The Rashbam himself is answering. So why earlier when it came to aggravating the orphan or the widow, does Hashem not say, I'm going to pay you back because I heard their cry? He says, I'm going to pay you back because... Why didn't he say it earlier? Because over there, you were wrong. Over here, you're right. You're entitled to hold the collateral. So why is Hashem nevertheless hearing their cries? Because chanun ani. He's compassionate, and he's kind, and he's sympathetic, and he can't help when he hears a genuine and authentic cry. He cannot help but answer. The Medrash Chazal say, that's why we have in Tehillim, we have Tehillim that begin, Tefillah La'ani Kiyatov, beautiful Mordechai and David song, Tefillah La'ani, and we have Tefillah La'Moshe. Because the Ani, the person who's lacking, who needs, the person whose tefillah is so genuine and so real and so authentic, it rises to the level of tefillah lamoshe. A tefillah la'ani is at the level of a tefillah lamoshe. This is the most authentic. This is the most authentic. The Ramban writes the same thing. Choneinu mekabel tchinos kol adam af pi she'ein ahagun. Hashem hears our cries and our pleas, even when they're not correct or just. Migzeiras chinam. The Ramban says that word chanun, it's one of the Yud Gimel Midos of Hashem. The word chanun comes from the word chinam. It's free. It's unearned. It's not deserving. It's chanun, it's chinam. Shilotachshav loach bol salam asat tzaddik, says the Ramban. What the Pasuk is telling us is don't think, you know what? The collateral of the tzaddik, I'm going to give it back to him because God's going to listen to the cries of the tzaddik. Aval samas adam she'enenu tzaddik ekach v'lo ashivenu. But the collateral of the less than righteous, I don't have to give back. Let them cry all night to God. God's not going to answer them. L'fichach omer ki chanun ani, v'hashomea tzakas kol mischanin li. Hashem says, I am a chanun, and as a matnas chinam, as a free gift, anyone who's authentic and real. So, ladies and gentlemen, it was worth staying 2 minutes later, because I'm telling you right now, I'm not telling you, I'm sharing with you right now, what our rabbis tell us, which is, if you want to access Hashem's graciousness and goodness, His kindness, of course we strive to be righteous, to be tzaddikim and tzidkanios. But even when we fall short, there's still a way to pierce the curtains of heaven and to appeal to Hashem such that He can't help but hear. How do we earn His matnas chinam, His gift of chanun ani, when we are sincere and real? The reason Hashem hears the cry of the one who didn't get back the collateral is they're cold. And they're vulnerable, and they're exposed, and there's no more real tefillah than that, and that's what our tefillos need to be. They need to be real. That's why we say at the end of Ashrei, Karov Hashem l'chol karov, l'chol asher yikra'uhu, be'emes. You know who's close to Hashem? Only those, all those who call out to Hashem. How? We call out to Hashem, be'emes. We call out to Hashem in truth. What does it mean to call out to Hashem, be'emes? What does it mean to call out to Him in truth? So the Eitz Yosef says it means not be'emes, you know, how hard you shuckle, how loud you scream. It's not the fervor and the intent. What it means is, all prayers have to be genuine to be effective. What it means is be'emes, you have to be an emesdika person. L'chol asher yikra'u, to all who call out. And how do they call out? By being an emesdik person. You have to be genuine and truthful and honest. This too we have in our parsha. The Pasuk says, midvar sheker tirchak. Midvar sheker tirchak. And now you're supposed to understand midvar tirchak. Said Reb Zusha, Vanapali, the great Rebbe, Reb Zusha. You know how you understand midvar sheker tirchak? Midvar sheker! If you're a liar, tirchak. You can't be close with Hashem. Midvar sheker. As a result of sheker, if you're not truthful and honest and genuine, tirchak. You are distanced. You are at a distance from Hashem. So, echo asher yikra'uhu be'emes. Our tefillah has to be real and raw and genuine and authentic. And when it is, ki chanun ani, we get a matnas chinam. Hashem can't help but respond. This is so true, in fact, that when the Kohen Gadol left the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur, we say this tefillah, Yiratzon, we repeat in our machzer, Musaf on Yom Kippur, the tefillah the Kohen Gadol would offer. And he would ask for Shnas Gzeres Tovos Mufanecha, good year, Dagon V'tirish V'yitzar. And our version doesn't have what the Gemara has. The Gemara in Yuma and Daf Nun Gimel says, "V'lo tikanim lefanecha tefilas ovrei drachim." Hashem, the Kohen Gadol in the Kodesh HaKadoshim would walk out, and he'd be healthy and alive, and he'd say, "God, don't listen to the commuters. Don't listen to the ones commuting, the travelers. Don't listen to the commuters." What does that mean? It means that the people who were leaving didn't want the rain. So when we dive in for the rain, they said, "Don't make it rain, because if it rains, there could be a landslide, it's slippery, it's dangerous, it's hard to travel." And so the Kohen Gadol, in order to combat their tefillah, has to say to Hashem, "No, nevertheless, make it rain, we need the rain." So Rabbi J.J. Schechter wonders, why does the Kohen Gadol have to? Hashem just won't listen to their tefillah. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to rain, that's what's on the Kohen Gadol's mind. Kodesh Kadoshim, Motzei Yom Kippur, don't listen to their tefillah, make it rain nonetheless. And the answer is yes. Is there a more genuine tefillah than the person who's commuting, who's outside, who's exposed, who's vulnerable, who desperately doesn't want it to rain? Because that's such a heartfelt and authentic tefillah, the only thing that could combat it is the Kohen Gadol, Yom Kippur, the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The more authentic, the deeper, the more be'emes, the more honest and real our tefillah, the more chanun, the more it earns Hashem's compassion. That's what the Ramban, the Rashbam are explaining. Not just for the tzaddik, even for the one who is less than a tzaddik. As always, there's so much more to say, but have a great week.